something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
I'm Christian Sager.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And it's the day after Halloween here in the How Stuff Works office. How was your Halloween, guys?
Fabulous.
Yeah, I had a good one. I had to go hunting for like an actual Halloween experience though, because my wife and I got dressed up and we took the dogs out for a walk, and no one in like a mile radius of our house was really celebrating Halloween.
You're not saying hunting. You don't seem like a hunting kind of guy.
I was hunting
guy,
humans.
Christian.
That's what you do on Halloween, right?
For fun. But not hunting them for fun, hunting them in hopes of finding them.
Exactly. And I prefer the ones that are in costumes because they taste better. So we had to get in the car and drive to a suburban neighborhood where there was like full on Halloween going, and it was great.
Well, we just went around in our neighborhood. My son, his friend, their parents, and we all just walked around, did the trick or treating thing.
Yeah.
But there was one moment that was a little bit legitimately creepy. I'll say that kind of goes in with our recent creepypasta episode.
Oh, really?
So we were finishing up. It was dark. One or two houses left, and there are a lot of kids on this particular street that we are trick or treating on. And one of the kids turns around and he points past me behind my back and says. He's dressed as Slender Man. And I look around and there's clearly nobody dressed as Slender Man. There's like nobody even tall enough to be Slender Man.
Yeah.
And it like left me confused for a second. And I, for a brief moment, I considered, is he seeing something that only children can see? Is Slender Man back there?
And, wow. That would make the Slender Man thing even creepier
yeah.
if it was only children could see Slender Man.
But I wanted to question him. I didn't get a chance. I was like, hey kid, where is Slender Man? Point to Slender Man. Let's have a discussion about this.
Hey, Joe, what did you do?
I stayed home. Rachel and I stayed home. We gave out some candy to trick-or-treaters. We reheated some leftover chili, kind of nice Halloween feast, and we watched Tobe Hooper's Salem's Lot miniseries from the 70s with all of the haircuts.
Yeah.
The true horror
David
in that
Soul.
Movie.
Yeah.
The 70s haircuts, unbelievable.
That movie scared the hell out of me when I first saw it, but I was much younger. Yeah, the scene with the little boy floating up against the window.
Yeah, the vampires in it are really freaky.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it in forever, but I listened to a lot of Halloween mixes yesterday, and there was one in particular that threw in some samples from the Salem's Lot movie, the bit where the showdown between the master and the priest.
Oh,
Barlow and Callahan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I would sample the heck out of James Mason in that movie mm-hmm. because he is so smooth. Yeah, I love how they invert the classic monsters familiar, like in the Universal Dracula and, well, all the traditional Draculas. You get the crazy familiar. You get Renfield, who's mm-hmm. out of control, but he's also like imprisoned and not very potent mm-hmm. as a character. In this one, you got this smooth, suave James Mason in these fancy suits.
Yeah, he's basically Captain Nemo outside of the submarine. Hey, I got a question though. We're talking about Halloween, and actually, October's over, guys. That means that we can't do Halloween episodes for another year.
That's a bummer, though. You know us. If you're a regular listener, we kind of slip some Halloween in all year long.
Yeah, we'll sneak it in, I'm sure. But of course, we've been talking about Halloween for a month.
Yeah.
And in doing that, we managed to yet again let the Ig Nobel Prizes slip past us. So
we did, yeah.
We're going to make up for that this week and also provide maybe a kind of a palate cleanser, I guess, for anyone who wishes to move on from Halloween episodes for a little bit.
This will definitely be like your silly science series of episodes. Mm-hmm. So why don't we tell the audience, maybe some of them haven't listened to our previous Ig Nobel episodes, but we generally cover them every year. What are they?
Well, they have been awarded since 1991 by the publication The Annals of Improbable Research. The purpose of the award, according to the editors of the publication, is to, quote, honor achievements that first make people laugh, then make them think, and furthermore, they stress that the 10 prizes aren't necessarily meant to pass judgment on the winners. Instead, the official website emphasizes that the prizes, quote, celebrate the unusual, honor the imaginative, and spur people's interest in science, medicine, and technology. And the principal individual here in all of this is the editor of the Annals of Improbable Research, Mark Abrams.
And I would say that goes along with our mission here. And mm-hmm. so these kind of work together nicely in that, like, hopefully we give them a little bit of a boost. They point out this bizarre research that we can take a deeper look at. And we have more time on the podcast than they have in their live ceremony to actually like dive into the research here.
Yeah, I think one of the big take homes about it, I mean, obviously it is a reference to the Nobel Prizes where the like a Nobel Prize in chemistry or biology is a big deal. And it's usually a study that is going to have a huge impact. With the Ig Nobel Prizes, I think it definitely highlights this idea that we have touched on before, science as this slime mold making its way through a maze or a labyrinth. And the slime mold of science, as it explores the world, it is going to explore everywhere. It is going to look in every mundane pantry and closet. And that's one of the things the Ig Nobel Prizes celebrate. Some of these studies that we're going to discuss, it's one of those areas where you can say, well, why did science need to look into that? Mm. Why did money and effort and scientific rigor approach this portion of the world? And the answer is, well, because science must go in there.
And in some of these cases, it actually turns out to be important. Like stuff that seems totally ludicrous, which I don't know about you guys, but some of mine seem totally ludicrous. But, yeah. And in fact, like other episodes of our show have built off of the entire premise of Ig Nobels. Like, for instance, our necrophilia episode, basically we got the jumping point off of that from, I think it was like an Ig Nobel from like 5 years ago, maybe
longer.
Yeah,
the necrophilic duck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were able to find a whole ton of information. That's one of my favorite episodes. Yeah.
I remember after you guys had first been talking about doing that, we were in this long meeting. And at the end of the meeting, somebody came over to talk to me about something, and I realized what was on my computer screen was all this stuff about duck necrophilia.
Yeah, yeah. I hope they liked it. And if you out there haven't listened to the episode, you should, because it's really surprisingly not as grim as you would think. I mean, it's grim, but it's also like really educational, both in terms of the animal kingdom, but also psychology of human beings.
Yeah, it demystifies the topic, and I think manages to do so in a non-exploitive way.
So what?
And it's a great way to get through a meeting. Boring meeting. Hit up the duck necrophilia.
So what can we do that with today?
Oh, well, we have a host of studies here to touch on. There are 10 awards.
Right. So this is going to be part one of a multi-part episode.
Correct. How many episodes? Who knows? It might be two. It might be three. We'll see how it goes. So the approach here, as in previous years, is we divided these 10 prizes up. We each took three of them, and then there was one left over, and I ended up taking that one just because one of my other papers turned out to be a bit short.
Okay, well, it looks like I'm up to bat first.
All right. What do you have for us, Joe?
Well, this would be the physics prize this year, which was offered to Marc-Antoine Fardin for using fluid dynamics to probe the question, can a cat be both a solid and a liquid?
This is a real Schrodinger's cat slash not scenario.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I can see that. The cat's both a liquid and a solid until you look at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's for a paper called On the Rheology of Cats. So here's an experience I'm sure you've all had. You're at a restaurant. You get some French fries. You want to put some ketchup on your plate, but the ketchup at your table is the glass bottle.
Ah.
You know there may be trouble ahead. So you turn it up, you unscrew the top, you shake, jiggle, tap, and all that. But you can't get the stuff out of the bottle. It will not flow. Y'all have had this experience,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. That's when you have to – it's probably not very polite, but you have to get the butter knife out.
Yeah, I always stick a butter knife in there.
Just jam the knife in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And you just, but then you end up feeling like a real animal, which is always a shame because I find that – the glass bottle of ketchup, you tend to encounter it at not the highest level of restaurant because that kind of place is going to bring it out to you in a
little
dish.
A stew cup.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's also not a super cheap restaurant because otherwise you would have packets or you would have a plastic squeeze bottle or you would have a pump and little cups that you fill it up with. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice enough restaurant that you feel awkward jabbing a knife into a bottle like an animal.
You know, some restaurants take those glass bottles and they just refill them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the marrying
of course
of the
they
ketchup.
Do.
It's
yeah.
a holy
I worked
a holy
at a restaurant for 4 years while I was in college. That was part of the job, was refilling those.
Much cheaper to buy in bulk and then just pump it back in.
Oh, yeah.
But in that case, why wouldn't you use a squirt bottle? Anyway, so if you have ever had this experience and you've ever wondered why won't the ketchup come out, your interest in the subject of rheology has been ignited. Rheology is the study of how matter flows. So given your experience with the ketchup bottles, you can probably guess that this is a surprisingly complex field. A lot of variables are going to go into how a substance flows under various conditions. So you know that one glass ketchup bottle sort of cleanly evacuates onto your plate, maybe even faster than you want it to. And then the next one, same brand, same content, same bottle, just will not budge until you jam the knife in. So what makes the difference? There are a lot of variables. Temperature is a big one. You probably know this from cooking, right? You've got a lot of sauces, soups, other edible fluids that are very runny at a high temperature but almost solid at a low temperature. And there are just tons of rheology characteristics that you can chart. Exactly how does a flowing material react to different types of substrate materials? Like how does it flow on glass versus on some other type of material? Or how does it how far will it bubble up off the lip of a container before it overflows? There are all kinds of questions like that. So the measurement of a material's ability to flow is known as rheometry. And I think this paper technically qualifies as a foray into rheometry because it's going to be measuring cats.
And how well cats flow out of ketchup bottles?
Not quite ketchup bottles, but it gets surprisingly close.
Rheology
is actually kind of – it's one of those things that seems kind of dry at first, but it's more interesting the more you think about it. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus is famous for this insistence that the fundamental nature of the universe is sort of constant change. It's sort of like the static change. Since everything is always changing in a way, everything is always the same. You've heard that quote that no man ever steps in the same river twice. That's attributed to Heraclitus.
Mm-hmm.
But another way of expressing this idea is the aphorism panta rhei, which is Greek for everything flows, like we all flow down here, we'll flow too. And so everything changes, nothing remains still. And Fardin points out that the field of rheology is sort of along the same lines as this idea by Heraclitus. States of matter are not fixed features of the universe. They're expressed through a matter of time. So eventually forces act on every mass of particles to make those particles deform or flow in some way. Solid matter tends to deform over time. Liquid or gas tends to flow.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, this makes sense. So I'm thinking about like we recently talked about like these massive glaciers in Svalbard, and that some of these glaciers have different states inside of themselves. So some of them are more liquid and more solid than other states, and that causes them to move, the entire glacier to move at different paces. This is somewhat related.
Yeah, but that's a great example, because on a long enough time scale, glaciers do flow as well. Even though they're solid and you can walk on them, if you want to look over hundreds of years, they're sort of flowing. So a major factor in how things flow or resist flow is the state of matter. We all remember this from, you know, elementary school physics. But by traditional definition, you've got solids, liquids, and gas. And a solid is the state of matter which has both a fixed volume, it's not going to change in size, and a fixed shape, it's not going to change in shape. Liquid is the state of matter that's got a fixed volume but not a fixed shape, and instead it conforms to the shape of whatever contains it. And then gas doesn't have either one. It doesn't have a fixed shape or a fixed volume, but expands to fill whatever container it's in. Here's where the cat comes in. Now, being an animal, I think you generally assume the cat is more or less a solid, right?
Well,
it's kind of complex. It's a solid filled with liquids.
Yes.
That's true. Animals are kind of bags of juice.
Right. But then cats, I haven't read the study, but ever since I saw the title, I keep looking at my cat and watching her move. And she does have like a very flowy liquid movement to her, you know?
Totally. But it's not – I would say it comes through less when the cat is moving around and walking and more when the cat is at rest in various containers and substrates. So you guys are both cat owners. Mm-hmm. Haven't you seen the way a cat will sometimes seem to puddle in the bathroom sink or pour itself into a basket or box?
Oh, definitely the baskets and box. Like that seems to be universal.
Yeah, definitely. My female cat, Roan, is – She has an ability to like – she's a little overweight, but she has an ability to kind of just make her mounds of flesh kind of form around her in a liquid status.
Yeah. I mean, I remember this for – I've seen lots of cats that love to just sort of not just get into depressions and cavities in various types of containers, but seem to fill them perfectly to every edge like a liquid would.
Right.
So that inspired some people on the internet to make posts like cats are liquids. And then Fardan is basically like, I saw a thing on the internet that said cats are liquids. Let's find out. So he essentially takes a bunch of photos of cats and analyzes them using the criteria of rheology, the same way you'd measure, say, a mass of ketchup or paint or mud to understand the way it flows. A cat in a jar, a cat spread across a lot of bars, a cat in a basket. And what follows in the paper, I would say, is mostly just a bunch of in-jokes for rheologists, but I do think it's kind of interesting. The results are obviously that cats can have some unique rheological properties, combining apparent features of both solids and liquids.
Okay. But wouldn't that be true of basically any mammal?
Well, I mean, part
any
of it
– any fat, furry mammal.
Yeah. I think the fur and the sort of soft body is very crucial for the cat. Because
I'm probably a little bit solid and a little bit liquid.
Oh, yeah?
I'm like, what? Like 70% of my body is liquid.
Well, I mean, we are pretty much blood bags. Yeah. But I would say something about the shape of your body.
Okay.
So imagine yourself trying to get into a sink or a box or a basket and just fill it the way a cat appears to, like a liquid. Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem quite as easy for you and me, right?
Well, one of the things about cats, of course, is that they are extremely flexible.
Yeah.
And then they have these sort of various resting states that they'll go into, these kind of uniform resting states. So I like to think of it as you have the bread shape where the cat, you know, kind of tucks its legs in and it's
cat
kind of,
bus.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of cat bus
the
shape.
The cat loaf.
Yeah, the cat or a cat loaf, you could call it. There's also the bagel in which they curl up.
Uh-huh.
And then there's one, I think most of them do this, but my cat Mochi definitely does this one where she just kind of like lays like she's been hit by a truck or something, you know, where it's just completely sprawled out.
Uh-huh.
But all of these, they do look like different animals in these different shapes. And it's really hard to nail down exactly what the shape of their body is.
Yeah. But my flesh isn't as loosely hanging off of my body as it does on my cats.
Right. Yeah. On cats, you feel like you can just move it all over the place. And the fur really helps also. The fur gives the illusion that there's like a much more body there than there actually is. And that part of the body obviously can be deformed into almost any shape.
That's why when you give a cat a bath, it is like one of the saddest things ever, because they're miserable, but also they lose this ability you're talking about.
Right. So that's part of the thing. A shaved cat would not appear to be a liquid in the same way a very furry cat is. Mm-hmm. But I think it's pretty funny in the paper. Like, a lot of these are obviously – a lot of these things he says in the paper are funnier if you are a rheologist or you're familiar with all these concepts. But they're still pretty funny even to an outsider. Like, one is a picture of a cat in a basket, and it's a very small basket. So picture a large cat in like a small French fry basket.
Okay.
And it's – gathered up into the basket, clearly filling it entirely, but puffing out over the top and hanging over the sides. And he analyzes this photo by saying, quote, cat on a super philidophobic substrate showing a high contact angle. Another one, he's got a jar turned on its side with the mouth facing out, and there is a kitten pretty much completely filling the jar. And he says, quote, tilted jar experiment showing the yield stress of a kitten. So the yield stress would be like what kind of stress has to be put on a mass of liquid before it flows out of a container at a certain angle. So, for example, the ketchup in the bottle, a lot of times the ketchup will not come out of the bottle because you have not adequately met its yield stress in whatever form it takes in the bottle. Here we've got the kitten will not pour out of this jar because its yield stress has not been met.
So while this is funny, right, and it's written to be funny, it also seems like it's probably important because it illustrates the principles of rheology in a way that basically backs up how well they work.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I would say that this paper seems to me to be jokier than most of the other papers we're looking at this time. Like, he actually does do some math in the paper and actually applies the rheological principles, does real analysis, but it's mostly, I think, just for the purpose of being funny, especially to other rheologists. Mm-hmm. But I think it matters, and he mentions in the paper some ways in which it might matter. Like, one thing is that cats are unlike most other types of liquids you would measure the flow of because they are self-powered and self-moving. Mm-hmm. And there are some analogies here to other things that you might actually want to study. Like, studying the flow of self-powered materials does matter in a lot of scenarios, like studying the movement of large packs or flocks of animals, or studying the flow of crowds of humans under various constraints. And this is sort of me extrapolating, because I think that would also come into some different kinds of fields other than rheology. There's probably, you know, such a thing as just studying crowd dynamics. But
hold on. I got an idea of how this connects. Okay. So remember that movie World War Z?
Yes.
With the zombies, like. Mm-hmm.
Zombie flow,
basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the zombies, like, came together as, like, a hive mind and could, like, there's even one point where, like, I think they turned into a hand or something dumb like that, right? They formed structures kind of like fire ants, too.
You're talking about the movie.
The movie, not the book at all. Yeah.
Well, they would climb walls by piling themselves up against the wall and then scaling over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you could – let's say you were one of the CGI operators on that film and you needed to figure out how they would flow. Uh-huh. You could probably use the principles of rheology applied based on something like – on crowd dynamics.
Yeah, possibly.
Right?
Well, I mean, I would say that crowd dynamics – studying the flow of crowds and other self-powered types of flow could – have real consequences in, say, designing environments. For example, crowd crush and trampling are real things that happen when you get a bunch of people together in a place and they start flowing in a non-optimal way.
I did an entire Brainstuff episode on the science of crowd crushes.
And so I think maybe like understanding self-directed flow of biomaterials, whether it's a single animal or lots of animals acting as a pack, could help us better, maybe better design public spaces to accommodate sudden human crowd flow without leading to tragedies.
So cases where, say, a large group of people are screaming and flowing out of a movie theater.
Yeah.
And also cases where the blob is flowing out of the same movie theater after them. Both of these would be opportunities for rheology.
The rheology of the blob would be a great paper. Yeah. That's what this guy should write next.
Oh, I bet somebody has done that out there. I bet that's one of those things you could find.
But to your point about just raising awareness of rheology, I think that's a great case in point. On this show, I do not believe we have ever discussed rheology before, and here we are.
Yep.
discussing it.
Well, yeah. I think we should commit now. We should try to find at least one really, truly interesting rheology topic to cover within the next year.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe the blob. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will jump into another 2017 Ig Nobel winning study. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Robert, what do you have for us?
All right, so this was actually the first one that I snagged from this year's offerings because it is a paper that I have covered before, kind of ad nauseum, because there is a Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast episode, I believe, that touches on this. There was a video, and I'm pretty sure I did a blog post as well.
Oh, I remember this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
The title of the paper is Female Penis, Male Vagina, and Their Correlated Evolution in a Cave Insect. And this was a current biology paper from 2014.
I got to say, first of all, for our listeners, there's an image that's inserted here in our notes for Robert's referencing.
Insert is a good description.
Yeah, it is very difficult to tell what is happening here, but it is also very easy to imagine what is happening here. It's just these organ-like structures flowing into and out of each other with a male and female symbol on them. It looks somewhat insectile, or maybe there's just hair on everything. I can't tell.
Oh, it is a Cronenberg-y world that this image tempts us with. So basically, the reason that this the study was highlighted previously, the reason it won an Ig Nobel this year, is because it concerns the sex-swapped world of cave bugs, which I think we can all get behind. So specifically, we're talking about Brazilian cave insects of the Neotrogla genus. We're talking four distinct species here, and they mark the first documented example of an animal with sex-reversed genitalia. So as detailed in the Cell Press journal Current Biology, the females, quote, insert an elaborate penis-like organ into the male's much-reduced vagina-like opening during 40 to 70 hour long lovemaking marathons.
Wow.
So to clarify, would this mean that the male still makes sperm cells?
Correct.
And the female still makes egg cells?
Right.
But they bring them into contact by the female inserting an organ into the male to retrieve the sperm cells from inside.
Exactly.
It's just a different, like, formation, essentially.
Yeah, but it's unique is the thing. Like, there are no other examples of a sex or gender swapping like this robust.
Right, yeah. And this is, I mean, that's 40 to 70 hours. I mean, Sting would probably be embarrassed looking at this.
Well,
these cave bugs.
The thing is, of course, that Sting is a lover. And I think lovemaking is a bit anthropomorphic when you're talking about insects.
Yeah, I kind of agree, yeah.
Yeah, because the insect world is pretty brutal, and the lovemaking world of – really, the lovemaking world of a lot of organisms is fairly brutal. And as the
– I love how we've just landed on lovemaking instead of mating.
I don't know. It just sounds more romantic, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
So but there's more. There's some more brutal details here. As the team of Brazilian and Japanese researchers discovered, the female inserts her phallic gynosome into the male, and then the sex organ inflates, hooking a bevy of spines into the male's body to anchor the two insects together.
Now, this is not the only organism with penis spines.
Nope. No. In fact, there's evidence that human ancestors have had penis spines as
no
well.
No way.
Other hominids have had penis spines before, and I believe there is some genetic data you can point to.
Robert, tell me a little more about penis spines. I think I'm woefully undereducated here.
All right. So, yeah, it's like basically like a cactus penis, I guess you could describe it as, because basically there's sort of a reproductive arms race in many organisms, and this is where spines may serve to stimulate or anchor the organism into place, or it may serve in sexual conflict.
Now, I think you're probably out there thinking, like, what, so some insects have penis spines, that's it, right? No, I mean, like, mammals have penis spines.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Penis spines.
Corkscrew, kind of, right?
Yeah, humans should wake up every day and just be thankful that, for a number of things. But one of the things on the list should be that we don't have to contend with penis spines. In this case of the cave insect, the researchers think that it may have other functions aside from just anchoring it into place. It might have a role in genital stimulation or quote, in inflicting harm. So it's kind of hard to figure out. It's like the Brundle fly told us. There's no such thing as insect politics.
So wait a minute. Like, this could be a sex organ or a defensive or offensive weapon?
Well, only insofar as it plays into the war, the continual battle of sexual reproduction.
Yeah. Whenever I've read about this in the past, it's been a biological survival mechanism, I guess. And this is horrible from an ethical standpoint of humans, right? But the idea is that the one without the penis barbs can't get away. If
right.
they do not want to mate with the one with the penis barbs, once the barbs are attached, they're kind of stuck.
Right.
So I think that's what you mean by the inflicting harm, right? That it's sort of along the lines of if these were human beings, we would be referring to this as like a masochistic act.
Now, the gynosome in this case, it does not deposit material like a male penis. There's no semen coming out of it. There's no sperm deposit. Instead, this gynosome, it receives sperm as well as capsules of nourishment, sort of a gift or a bribe to encourage lots of mating. We see this in a number of different insects typically.
The spiders too. They're the spiders that create a little wrapped up gifts. The males bring them to the females to encourage mating, though sometimes they bring them something empty to trick them.
So this is essentially like an inverted vagina dentata.
You could think of it that way. Sure. Yeah. So the interesting.
Wait, would it be inverted? Would it be an extroverted vagina dentata?
Maybe that's probably the correct terminology.
No,
to
it's
use
probably
here.
Not.
I don't. By the way, also vagina dentata is something that we've covered on the show separately. That was a joke. That's not actual like biology.
I guess that you would say it's kind of eversion. I believe.
Sure.
Everted. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like the turning out of a pocket. And then
yeah,
the
that's exactly what I was
pocket.
Thinking yeah. of. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very complicated to try and sort of fit the Tetris equation here in one's mind.
Genital Tetris.
Now, that act of gift-giving that we were talking about, the nourishment, the researchers have argued here that this is likely what drove the evolutionary development of the female penis, the gynosome, here to begin with, again, getting into this phallic arms race.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Now, why is it funny? I think that's pretty obvious, because it is a study that involves sex and the idea of a female organism penetrating a male organism.
So sex, tee-hee.
Yes. Basically, that's it.
And it's benign violation.
Well, yeah, as long as you're not one of the male cave bug, I guess.
Right, yeah,
But yeah, it's basically just a funny sex headline, right? But it is still important. I think it's such a startling reversal of everything we've come to expect from sexual reproduction. And as the researchers point out, the reversal here is in the, quote, rapid evolution and diversification, unquote, of genitalia. So male genitalia is usually the one to develop, quote, coercive adaptations, while female genitalia remains relatively simple. Plus, it's the females doing the competition here for males and their seminal gifts. So the biological reversal results in a very robust behavioral reversal.
Hmm. So perhaps with this particular species, there's more females than males, or there's some kind of a, I don't know if sociological is the right term, but there's a setup in which like they have to compete for the attention of the males in order to reproduce.
Well, it sounds like the females would be the ones doing the courtship activities.
Right.
Yeah. And it's interesting to look at that as, like I say, the biological reversal, and then that reverses the behavior as well.
Okay.
I really like this study because I think flipping things around like this, it shows us that sexual reproduction is all about just the combination of these two things, and the form those things take and all the behavior and culture associated with it is merely a product of natural selection.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And it makes me sort of think, like, where's it going as well? Not just with insects, but with like all species, you know, although for the most part, I mean, for the last like million some odd years, most of our species have stayed the same reproductive wise, but things can change.
Well, and it also,
especially when we start changing ourselves.
It's also one of those studies that just raises the possibility, like, what if things had gone the other way? What if we were in a world where the vast majority, almost all organisms that engage in sexual reproduction entailed the female penetration of the male?
Yeah.
Right.
And we were looking at a weird cave bug that did the opposite.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It does put it all into perspective.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we have one more study here for you from the 2017 Ig Nobels.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
So I'm going to take us from inverted genitals to an entirely different place. This is the Peace Prize for the Ig Nobels this year. And it revolves around the didgeridoo. You guys familiar with the didgeridoo?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I'm actually... Can our producer Alex insert the sound of a didgeridoo in here so that our audience kind of gets an idea of what we're talking about?
No, wait. That was a didgeridoo. Here we go.
And if nothing else, I think everybody should recognize that sound from any, like, Australian exploitation film where something mystical happens.
What, now, was there a bunch of didgeridoo in Howling 3, The Marsupials?
I feel like there was. I mean, if there wasn't, it was that was a colossal failure on their part.
Yeah. Well, if there was, those marsupials would sleep better than most people.
No way.
Yeah. Huh. We've got some facts here, folks. Didgeridoo playing as alternative treatment for obstructive sleep apnea syndrome in a randomized control trial. That is the paper that I am talking to you about today. The essential idea here is they demonstrated that regular playing of the didgeridoo is an effective treatment for obstructive sleep apnea and snoring.
Huh.
So do either of you guys snore or do you have sleep apnea? I don't have apnea. My dad does, but I snore a decent amount.
I have relatives who have snoring issues, but yeah, I don't have it myself.
So have you ever thought to yourself, like, what if I just played the didgeridoo a little bit more? Would that make it better? Science says yes.
So this is you're playing the didgeridoo music to settle down for the evening, or you're listening to it, or you
just
have
having it in your life. It doesn't even have to be right before you go to bed.
I'll
explain. Okay. So these researchers, they took 25 patients who had apnea or hypopnea in an index between 15 and 30. That's, you know, a measurement system that they use for like how bad these conditions can get. And they had them do didgeridoo lessons for 4 months. And the participants played didgeridoo for about 6 days a week for about 25.3 minutes a day. and it significantly improved both their and their partner's sleep disturbances. Now, we might wonder, like, what's the biological function here? Like, what is going on? Well, okay. Sleep disorders of this type, they're caused by the collapse of the upper airway. So the most effective intervention is usually what's called positive airway pressure therapy.
So that's like when you see people who have the mask they go to sleep with positive pressure.
Yeah. To be honest, like when I have sinus problems, what I end up doing is just pushing on my sinuses around my nose. I think it's a similar effect, but this is obviously like more methodical than what I'm doing. Okay. For some patients, though, that's not suitable, so they need other interventions. The researchers involved in this experiment, they had heard from a didgeridoo instructor. He said, hey, my students and I, we've had a complete reduction in our snoring, and we're not sleepy during the daytime after we've been practicing didgeridoo for several months.
Huh.
And they thought, wait a minute, is this because didgeridoo is training the muscles in their upper airways? So, okay, they set up this methodology, and they recruited patients at study centers in Switzerland. Then they randomized these patients into an intervention group and a control group, and then they excluded candidates who were currently trying out that positive airway pressure therapy and any drugs that act on the central nervous system, as well as anybody who was trying to lose weight or weighed too much or drank too much alcohol, because all of these things could be contributing factors. The patients in the intervention group took the didgeridoo classes, and they learned the following things. I've never played a didgeridoo before, so this was new to me. Circular breathing is a technique that enables you to maintain sound for a long period of time by inhaling through your nose while maintaining airflow through the instrument itself, and use your cheeks as bellows.
Okay.
So this is like the first kind of important part of this. And then the second is to optimize the complex interaction between your lips, your vocal tract, and the circular breathing I just mentioned, so that the vibration in the upper airway is more readily transmitted down to the lower airway.
Well, I guess one thing to keep in mind here is that with didgeridoo music, you don't hear a bunch of, staccato. You don't hear a dot, 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 dot. You hear long droning tones.
It's sustained.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Which I imagine also helps contribute to this, right?
Now I've got a question. Are there any drone or doom metal bands that incorporate didgeridoo?
There have to be. There have to be. I'm almost positive there is. Yeah. But do you think they're from Australia or somewhere else?
I don't know. You get into an interesting area where it would be like an aboriginal subset of drone music, kind of like traditional drone music.
Like what happens when you run a didgeridoo through an orange amp?
I mean, I have to admit, like, most Sun-O records sound like they have didgeridoo in the background anyways. But so here's the thing. How do you measure this? Well, it turns out there's several indexes to measure the effect on sleep. And so they brought these patients in, they gave them these indexes as surveys, and then they used cardiorespiratory sleep studies on them. Finally, they gave the patients just a generic health and quality of life survey just to find out, you know, what's all going on, making sure everything's working the right way. They found this. The patient's quality of sleep actually didn't differ significantly between the people who played didgeridoo and the people who didn't. But their partners reported less sleep disturbances.
Ah.
Hmm.
They also observed a significant effect of the didgeridoo playing on apnea or hypopnea. And so actually when they compared this to the positive airway pressure therapy, they found they're similar, but the didgeridoo has a slightly smaller effect. But essentially, like, if you're out there and you're listening and you're like, oh, this is a problem for me, and maybe you have to wear one of those masks at night or something like that, maybe play didgeridoo instead. Like, you know what it reminds me of?
We would say obviously follow your doctor's recommendation.
Yes.
But at least give didgeridoo a try, maybe.
Yeah. Do both.
Well,
hey man, imagine how well you'll sleep if you do
both. One of the great things about the didgeridoo that I've picked up on is that even if you don't play it or you never play it, it still looks great propped up in a corner.
Sure.
Yeah,
right.
It's always a discussion starter.
Well, I was thinking about how this reminds me of – and this leads us back to cats. We've done some research into cats before on this and on brain stuff, talking about cat purring and the function of cat purring as like a method of healing both the cat and maybe people who are on the cat or like the cat's laying on or something like that. Hmm. So the didgeridoo kind of made me think the same thing. Like there's an act of the vibration that's working on here, but obviously also they're building up actual muscles and responses inside the respiratory system. So why is it funny? Well, because the sound and the look of the instrument is amusing. Everybody giggles at the didgeridoo, right?
Because g'day, mate.
But why is it important? Well, this is an actual thing that can relieve a disorder that many people suffer from. You know, most people would go, that's a ridiculous thing. Why would we research that? If the didgeridoo instructor said, hey, this may actually have some benefits to your patients, most people would just go, yeah, sure. That's anecdotal. But they did the research and they found out that it's a real thing.
Well, it comes back around to the idea of science as this slime mold.
Yeah.
You know, opening every cabinet and even the cabinets that seem a bit silly, that we seem reluctant to, you know, to give much credence to, the science is going to look in there and see if there's anything worth having.
You know, this makes me think we could do probably whole episodes on the medical science of wind instruments. Like, yeah. We got to go from this to bagpipe lung.
Right.
You know, the inverse.
Is that a condition? Like, oh, I'm suffering from bagpipe lung.
Oh, man. So you're a bagpipe player. And you maybe – it's actually not funny because this has literally killed people.
Oh, man.
But yeah, bagpipe lung is a thing that where your bagpipe becomes infested with fungus without you realizing.
Because
you're continually –
As you're continually
experiencing this constricted airflow through this fungus-filled cavity, you are feeding all of these horrible particles into your lungs and people don't realize what's going on and it can kill you.
Oh, man.
That – sounds like a great idea for an episode.
Not to be a downer, guys.
Huh.
Remember, didgeridoo.
Well, here's the
they
thing.
Can help people.
Yeah.
G'day, mate.
If you play bagpipes, also play the didgeridoo.
Just to balance it
I
out.
Don't think, okay. I don't think that they reverse the conditions, but you'll feel better about one thing while you're feeling worse about the other.
All right. We actually have one more before we close out this installment of our 2017 Ig Nobel series, and it is the Fluid Dynamics Prize.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That sounds exciting. Wait, we already did fluid dynamics with those cats.
Somehow, I guess rheology is slightly different than fluid dynamics, or maybe fluid dynamics is a larger subset category.
I know fluid dynamics is certainly it's an area that always intrigues me because, for starters, they do have at least one huge conference a year, and you see a lot of cool papers coming out of it, and it ranges tremendously because. For instance, one of the best fluid dynamic papers, the most enthralling that I came across, was a paper that dealt with how nuclear fallout moves through a metropolitan environment.
Yeah, that seems important.
You know, with like flows of radioactive material hitting buildings, like cascading up buildings and so forth, and how we might be able to map the flow of these materials.
Oof. Yeah. Hey, I got a fun footnote to that.
Okay.
The most expensive book in the world is a book that was written by Leonardo da Vinci, and it's owned by Bill Gates, and it's about fluid dynamics.
Huh.
Yeah.
And it's written backwards.
You have to
read it in a mirror.
Right to left?
Mm-hmm. It's written so that you have to use a mirror to actually read it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you should ask Bill Gates sometime if you can borrow it.
Yeah,
that sounds pointless.
Hey, the whole thing's actually scanned and online.
Well, you know, but one of the great things about fluid dynamics is that it certainly touches on some rather grandiose topics, but it also is just everywhere around us. Like I have not looked up a study about this, but every time I'm making a smoothie in the morning, in the blender, I think about fluid dynamics. Now, like somebody out there has surely applied some serious scientific thinking to what's going on with my blender, like how the stuff blends, or in many cases doesn't blend, how you end up with that section of smoothie on the top that's doing nothing while the bottom part is swirling around.
I would imagine
you
like
need a better blender.
Smoothie King, obviously. Whatever those like chains are. Like those Smoothie King's the one we have here in Atlanta.
With the big square looking blenders.
They must have like scientists on their teams whose whole job is to figure out like how well these things can come up through straws.
I've read about this. I think the best solution is to stick your hand down in there while it's going.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking you were going with the cat thing.
Don't follow my advice, folks.
All right. Well, this particular study is titled A Study of the Coffee Spilling Phenomena in the Low Impulse Regime. So
are we in the low impulse regime right now?
I think we're in the high impulse regime.
I love that phrase of the low impulse regime.
Nice.
Sounds like a band I would be really into.
Yeah. It sounds like something Captain Picard would say.
So basically, this paper asks the question, from a fluid dynamic standpoint, why does spillage occur with coffee, also with wine, and how might we limit it? And the great thing about this paper is it touches on a universal experience.
I am the guy who inevitably always spills coffee on themselves. I don't know what it is.
You leave a trail of brown liquid.
Yeah, to the point where my wife knows when I've bought coffee and have been driving in the car because she's just like, there's coffee stains everywhere. What is wrong with you? I eat like a raccoon, and apparently with coffee, I just throw the cup at my face, I guess. I don't know. But even just when it has a lid on it, and I move it around, it somehow gets everywhere.
This is one of my favorite features of classic animation. If you watch old Disney movies, they're always depicting cups of liquid sloshing around crazily while people are consuming them. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
People swinging a beer stein or a wine glass or something like that, and it's just splashing and sloshing all over the place.
Well, and that kind of movement tends to it tends to be everywhere in these old cartoons. The people are kind of sloshing back and forth. The action is kind of sloshing. I guess animation historians have some terminology to throw behind this.
Yeah, I would imagine it has something to do with the form at the time, that the animators and illustrators were probably trying to figure out how best to render liquid in cartoon format. Same as with CGI, when it's super impressive how great water is rendered in CGI.
I guess part of what I'm thinking of is that it's always in classic animation, actions and the themes they signify are exaggerated. If you watch old Disney movies, whenever somebody's drinking something, usually it's in some kind of feast scene that's signaling gluttony or something that. And so there's all this depiction of excess, and maybe the sloshing is one aspect of that.
I immediately thought of Fantasia and Mickey carrying the buckets of
a lot
water.
Of sloshing
splashing everywhere. Yeah.
So this particular paper is a South Korean paper, and it was published in Achievements in the Life Sciences, and it's by Yuan Han. It's from 2016, and I'm not going to summarize a lot of the paper because a lot of the paper is just sort of breaking it down from a fluid dynamic standpoint, what's happening with a sloshing cup of coffee or a sloshing goblet of wine. But the fun part is that this article doesn't just describe what's happening, it presents solutions.
Nice. Okay.
Yes.
So wait, you're telling me I might have some solutions for my coffee problems?
Yeah, I'm saying that when we're done with this section, you will have new ideas to implement in your coffee consumption and your handling of a coffee mug.
I like you, Ig Nobels.
Apart from sippy cups?
In a way, they're sort of a sippy cup. They do recommend you could hold the coffee mug with a small plate on top of it. Just cover the coffee mug. That seems obvious. You don't really need a scientist to point that out. But yeah, maybe if we didn't have an open container of liquid, we wouldn't have to deal with sloshing.
But I assume they have better solutions than that.
We'll see if you think they're better.
Okay.
Here's a quote from the paper. Moreover, we showed that either walking backwards or holding the cup with a claw hand posture led to significant changes in the driving force frequency spectrum, suggesting a method to suppress resonance. So, one of the ideas here is, simply walk backwards with your coffee mug.
Okay.
But the other is –
I feel like I would spill even more with that, but okay. I'm listening.
The other is to – make a claw with your hand and hold the coffee mug top down.
Not bottom up.
Right. So you're holding your coffee like you're some sort of a cartoon vampire.
Yeah.
Carrying it around from the top.
You're the crane, game.
Yeah, it's like the crane game where instead of grabbing a bunch of cheap stuffed animals, you're grabbing a single coffee mug.
I know.
This is a better method. It makes you look kind of stupid, but it is a better method according to the scientific data.
Now, I know, Robert, you haven't seen the new season of Twin Peaks. Joe, you have, right?
No, I actually haven't.
Oh, okay.
Yet.
So neither of you
I'm going to. Don't spoil anything.
No, I'm just going to say there is a character named Dougie in it, and Dougie holds coffee in the claw method, but he does two-handed claw where he grabs it from the side and he holds it with both of his hands are clawed and he holds onto it tightly like that.
Hmm. Man, I have a totally different idea of the claw hold, and it comes from my days serving in restaurants where the claw was how you fit three water glasses in the same hand. You got this clutch thing.
But it's underneath, right?
Yeah, from the bottom where they fit between the first finger in the, well, I'm not going to describe all that, but yeah, you can get three water glasses in one hand if you use the claw.
What was the spillage like with that?
Not too much, actually.
Yeah? Okay, mm-hmm. It might have hit on a similar property. But that's the other thing that comes to mind in the service industry. You can't really use the top-down claw method to bring someone their coffee at a restaurant.
They're
going to
think
they're going to say, take that back.
Sure.
You're basically sticking your hand in my beverage.
But it looks like here that they have come up with a design that could fix that problem.
Yes.
It in your mouth and then spit it out into the cup at the table.
Well, at least it would be closed, right? And then you're prepared for a wonderful cinematic response to any jokes that the customer may share.
Right.
But no, in addition to providing new ways to carry existing coffee mugs, this study does present an alternate coffee cup design. Quote, it is evident that a decrease in the radius of the cup can significantly increase the resonance frequency by dividing the cup into smaller cylindrical cells.
Oh, cool.
So
I like how this looks. It's like a coffee cup, but it looks like it's got a bunch of syringes with the top sawed off inside of it.
It's impossible to drink out of.
It looks impossible to drink out of. It looks a bit silly to say the least.
You can't use a spoon for sure. I mean, a straw.
Yeah. Basically, the picture looks like a glass, like a cocktail tumbler.
Sure.
And inside it, there are all of these glass vials.
Yeah, it's packed with test tubes.
Yeah. So imagine if you drank your coffee out of a bunch of test tubes that have been lashed together as opposed to a single broad drinking vessel.
I mean, what this looks like is you'd be sipping out of the bottom two test tubes and the rest would just be pouring into your eyes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, you couldn't throw it back, that's for sure.
And it would be really – you would have to mix your cream and sugar in a different cup entirely before you even pour it.
The thing that gets me about this – really both of these suggestions, both the coffee cup design and the coffee mug handling method is that what if this is the way? What if these are the changes we need for a better system of drinking and carrying coffee around, but we're ultimately going to just be too vain to change? Because yes, drinking out of this bizarre contraption that looks like a bunch of test tubes looks silly. Carrying your coffee mug around with a claw hold looks silly. But there are other things that we've seen in life where the sillier looking method is more successful and we don't do it because it looks silly.
I'm going to offer a really stupid method, but it's my method. Uh-huh. I pretty much never spill my coffee because I never fill my cup more than 2/3 of the way.
Well,
because I don't want to get the fear.
But the thing is, Joe, there have been so many times where I've been coming in from my front porch. So I work on my front porch a lot when I'm teleworking, and I'll always have a coffee mug with me. And sometimes the coffee mug, you know, it's down to the last little bit, but you can still, trust me, you can still slosh the heck out of a cup of coffee when you have less than 1/4 of a cup.
Yeah.
So
if you're like trying to grab hold of a child or something like
that. Yeah, or if you have a laptop and you have the coffee mug on top of the laptop. But the thing that this reminded me of, and I am not a sports person at all, but I heard it was either a Radio Lab or a This American Life episode in the last several years about the granny shot in basketball, about how this is the most effective way to make a free throw.
So describe the granny shot.
The granny shot is it's generally associated with if you don't know how to bowl or you don't know how to throw a basketball, you simply hold it in your hands and you sort of
stand legs apart.
Legs akimbo, yeah, and you just dangle it down there between your legs and then throw it up.
Underhanded.
Underhanded. Yeah. A double-handed underhand throw with legs akimbo.
So you're saying that people using this method get a higher frequency percentage of shots than people who don't use it?
Yeah, basically the idea is that it's been proven that this is the most effective method, even in especially in the NBA. Uh-huh. And those who utilize this method make more free throws.
But it's pretty rare that you'll see this during a game.
Because it looks stupid. Yeah, because there's this idea that if you throw the ball that way, you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
That it has less finesse to it, even if it's more effective.
Yeah.
Even if it could ultimately, you know, make a difference in winning games, it's still something – it's a line that most basketball players are not willing to cross.
Sounds like there's a window for somebody to come in and moneyball all this thing.
I guess, yeah. But I wonder
– I'm sorry. I just just use Moneyball as a verb, like I'm some ad executive.
Well, let's quickly pivot away from that and we'll move back to the coffee cups.
Yeah, but it raises the question, what if this is the best way? This is the scientifically verified way to drink coffee and we're just all going to ignore it as we've been ignoring it because, like I say, this came out last year. And nothing has changed.
Yeah.
Now that it's making the rounds with the Ig Nobel Prizes, is it more likely that people will listen to it? Will there be like one person in a given workplace that embraces the crazy test tube filled coffee mug?
If those tubes were available on the market and they weren't like prohibitively expensive, I'd give it a shot.
Yeah, maybe we should. It could be an experiment. Maybe listeners out there will try it themselves. If you don't try the test tube oriented coffee mug, then try the top down claw method of holding the cup and let us know how it goes. All right, so there you have it. Four down, yeah. Six to go.
Yeah, so follow us on our next episode about Ig Nobels. We're going to release this right one after the other, sequentially, mm-hmm. I believe is how they say it. But you know what? If you've got any questions for us about coffee mugs or weird insect genitalia or how you make liquid cats, where can they get in touch with us, Joe?
Well, you can go to stufftoblowyourmind.com where you've got everything we do, including Robert's excellent blog posts. He'll do some space music. He'll do some monsters. I don't know. Are we going to get any monsters in November? Surely we will, even though we've just...
Yeah, surely I can find a monster, too, to throw in the November mix.
But that's, of course, where you can get all of our podcasts. But also, you can go wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to us right now, so you probably know how to do that. If you're not subscribed, subscribe, and you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.